Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 96, recorded March 27th, 2013. Andy Inatko. It's time for Triangulation. I love this show, a chance for me to sit down and spend an hour with some of the best minds, most interesting thinkers, the people who are really changing the world and have such interesting ideas. And I'm so excited. It's funny because I've known this guy for a long time to get our guest on this week, Andy Inatko. And you certainly know his name. He's one of the great Macintosh journalists out there. He's written for the Chicago, continues to write for the Chicago Sun-Times as their tech editor there. He's our host on Mac Break Weekly. He does some other podcasts on his own, including Andy's Almanac on the 5x5 Network. Andy, welcome to Triangulation.
It's nice to see you at a respectable hour of 6 or 7 in the evening. You're getting me up at 1 in the afternoon, you know, on the East Coast for Mac Break. That's kind of a hassle.
I am. You know, it's funny because I feel like I know you so well. We worked together for 5 or 6 years now, and I remember the first time I met you, running into you at a Mac World, I think it was. And I couldn't miss you because I saw the hat and the sideburns. And that's your trademark.
Which did you see first?
It was all of a piece. You were going up an escalator. And I said, hey, Andy Inatko. I did. I was so excited to meet you because I'd read you for years. When did you what's the story? What's the genesis of Andy Inatko, journalist? When did you start writing? Was it in college?
Yeah, but like my first year in college – I started writing for my local user group, the Boston Computer Society Mac group, and that would sort of been the equivalent of like having a Tumblr blog where all you have to do is write and they will print it in there with what used to be a thick, glossy user group magazine because we were supported by like actual annual memberships. But it was a great time, a great opportunity to like learn how to write because really as all volunteer effort, you were looking for, they were all just looking for people who could write on deadline and about the meetings and stuff. So that was a great training ground. And then I also was helping to run the meetings every single month. I used to do this thing because oftentimes I think you remember what it was like in the late 80s, early 90s or whatever, where you'd have this overhead projector that would plug into this, you know, the classic Macintosh with some sort of kludged up thing to get the video out of there. And it was always breaking down or something. It was like pre Mac OS 10. So the Macs were always crashing and freezing up during a demonstration. And so we always needed to have something standing by so that we could cover like the 10 or 15 minutes of like hurried diagnostics that were happening, you know, to get the demonstration or the tutorial running again. So what I used to do is that I used to have this is going somewhere, I promise you. I used to like leave my Return of the Jedi lunchbox like at the entrance to like the auditorium, and I have like a stack of index cards and a bunch of golf pencils. And as people are coming in, if they have a question, like a technical question, like a Genius Bar type question, write it down on the card, drop it in there, and then, you know, during these downtimes, I would just, you know, reach into this lunchbox, grab a question, and start answering stuff. And sometimes I knew what the answer was off the top of my head. Sometimes I would start off a discussion, but it was a real think on your feet sort of gesture. And it also came in handy because there was one meeting in which the editors-in-chief of Mac World, Mac User, and Mac Week were our guests for that day. And so I wound up, we had a really bad time with the hardware. And so I was up there for a good like 20 or 30 minutes just answering questions. And I was also I have to say that I kind of inflated my own knowledge a bit because I was pulling off an old mentalist trick where you have like a sealed envelopes and you're holding up to your forehead and trying to guess like what's inside this envelope, or I'm guessing that you've written down your malady. I see a woman called Emma and she's having a problem with her ankle, and you rip open. And of course there is this woman called Emma. Oh my God, you got that just without even opening the envelope. Unbeknownst to anybody, you actually have been opening these envelopes and you're actually answering the response that you got one envelope beforehand. So that would give me like an extra 3 minutes.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah. So actually, instead of like, you know, I think that it might be like you might, it might be an intermittent termination problem on your SCSI bus. Cause if it really is an original Mac too. So I was having some fun at people's expense.
That's clever. I got to steal that idea.
Yeah, exactly. I've used that a couple times where in case you need to look a little bit more insightful than you actually are. Anyway, so, it was a combination of like kismet and good planning. I was hoping that I'd have an opportunity to like press some of my user group writings into the editor's hands. So I had like, you know, Manila. I was so proud that for real, like real professional, I put them in Manila envelopes and everything and made sure that I had multiple copies. And there, you know, afterwards I was known as you're the guy who was answering those questions. You know, have you ever considered writing for whatever? So, well,
as a matter of fact,
I sometimes did. And it was cool. So Mac user like had me write a sample thing. And 3 months later I had a column. It was wonderful.
Wow. Yeah, remember the BCS was a great – there were two great Macintosh users groups. I was a member of the West Coast, the BMUG, Berkeley yep. Macintosh users group, and BCS in Boston. Did they do the same thing that BMUG did? BMUG would only put out its newsletter once a year, but it was like a phone book.
No. The Boston Computer Society Mac group had a monthly newsletter, and it was about the size of what would have been a regular monthly periodical around that time. So maybe about a quarter inch thick and full of like columns that have been written by the subgroup members and stuff like that. The BCS, remember the Mac group was part of, I think that at some point there were about 7 dozen different groups for every single special interest group out there. So right. Just with Mac people alone, there were something like 9 special interest groups, including the developers, the desktop publishers, the newbies, that sort of stuff. So there was never any shortage of content coming in from people.
You were a computer geek in high school?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was the annoying kind of computer geek because it was cool because we had an Apple II Plus or IIe at the house. And so all my spare time was spent either coding or word processing, writing some stuff. And so unfortunately for my computer teachers, I had already gone not only past basic language, not only past Pascal, but now I was writing machine code. And I had, in the interests of, shall we say, understanding more about how commercial games are protected against theft and illegal redistribution, I had learned a lot about what makes disk drives work. And as part of that, I had to write a whole new operating system to get things to work. As a result, I could make these computers do things that the teacher did not even know was actually possible because, again, remember that this was the olden days when you bought a computer and Apple would say, sure, here's a complete disassembly of all of the ROM codes inside there. So if you want to replace that with anything you want, go right ahead.
Those times have changed. Yeah. It's interesting. So you were hacking. In those days, the games most often used defects in the disks, right? And they would they would try to read a disk sector, a known disk sector, and if they came back normal, they'd go, yeah, you made a copy. But if it came back, can't read this, it's pirated. Were you cracking that?
There were so many clever things that were being done there because every single time it would boot up, it would have to start off with a specific track of a specific sector. After that, all bets were off, depending on how clever they would get. I remember that I think the name of the software was Dazzle Draw. I've almost became like Radar O'Reilly, where I would put my hand on top of the disk drive and I could just feel what the stepper motor was doing. And at some point I would like take the cover off so I could watch to see what the stepper motor was doing and knowing that, it's going to places that it's not supposed to be going to. Wow. Dazzle Draw when I finished that crack, I kind of stood up and applauded the makers of this because they had done intersecting spiraling tracks. Instead of being concentric, they were laid out in spirals so that it would be really, really difficult for someone to like follow the movement of the data being loaded in and shove that off someplace else. And so I'm like, man, I almost don't want to do. I almost want. If you were paying me by the hour for how much time I was spending on trying to copy this disc, I would probably be making $300 instead of the $40 this game would have cost. But you learn a lot. It's a lot of fun, and you're like, you wish you could meet the person who came up with this copy protection scheme because man, it was clever and it taught you a whole lot about what was possible.
It did. It became a lot less about piracy and much more about just hacking. having fun.
Yeah. And that's why I always have a certain amount of respect for white hat hackers, because most people, when they hear about someone who is doing the digital equivalent of twisting doorknobs and trying to pick locks and trying to see how good a combination lock is, they see someone who was trying to get at your credit card information or trying to do no good stuff. When I really am part, as a kid, I remember that tradition of, I wonder how this works, yeah. And I wonder how well protected this thing is, and I wonder what I could learn about what makes this system actually work. And once you get to it, really playing the game or using the utility wasn't really the fun. The fun was actually unraveling that mystery. It was like the Babel Fish all over again.
I wonder where kids are doing that today. Things are so complex that I doubt. I mean, I think about DVD John, who was just a high school student when he cracked the code that was used to protect DVD movies and wrote DCSS. But nowadays, I mean, if you were going to try to crack Blu-ray, forget it. I wonder what the kids today are doing as their way of learning and exploring and perhaps, you know, being a little bad.
I'm really quite jealous because Apple will not send them the source code to all of their products like they would send us the source code to the Apple II. But they have Xcode. Not only that, but they have in the internet and a community of developers.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Who will help them and teach them how to write apps. And I mean, I still remember when I was 17 or 18, and I was teaching at a summer computer camp for adults, where, again, run by the Boston Computer Society, where if you had a staff member who needed like a week worth of training on PageMaker or whatever, we basically rented a community college for a junior college for a month during the summer when they were shut down, use the dorms, use the classrooms. Mm-hmm. But they would also use another, like, child's computer camp, not from the BCS, but was also using the same property. And I remember a summer day when I'm going back from teaching a class and I see this kid walking across, happy as can be, holding like a C++ training manual. And I'm like, that kid is learning how to shut objective programming. And I still can't really understand objective programming because, oh man, I better learn how to like make butter or farm or something, because I'm never going to catch up to this 10-year-old kid.
What was your first computer? Was it a Mac?
No, I didn't get it. I couldn't afford a Mac for a long, long time. The family computer was an Apple II Plus, I think, which I had from junior high.
But Macs were out. You were still on an older computer.
Yeah, that was when I was in high school, and no, I was not going to ask my parents, "Hi, can you buy me a $2,500 computer?" there was a kid in my school who, I have to guess in retrospect, that their parents were going through a messy divorce and trying to curry his favor with expensive. He was like the Ferris Bueller bedroom, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But my really, it was unfortunately, I had to my first computer that I bought myself was a PC clone, because mm-hmm. I could afford $410.
Right.
My first Mac was actually a Mac 512, which was even at that point a couple years old, and I was only able to afford that because I was working in the computer department of a department store that had a very liberal policy on discounting stuff that was no longer on the price list. And so by sort of manipulating the innards to make sure it would never work properly when someone tried to fire it up, I was able to get it to stay there on the shelf for about a month and a half, at which point I was able to offer them like $90 for it, and they took it because, oh, well, it's a piece of junk. It doesn't really work. And then I would, of course, take it home and then, you know, reconnect the flyback transformer, put back in. Yeah,
it works. It's alive.
It was paralegal, but I needed a Mac.
Did you want to be a programmer? Was that what you thought you would end up doing?
Yeah, I mean, I went to school for computer science. I thought that.
Oh, I didn't know that. You're actually trained in this.
Exactly. I've built Turing machines back when you needed to make those out of Legos and in gear ratios. Well, not quite, but yes. I did think that I would either be a programmer, developer, and be writing like fiction for fun on the side. I was very pleased that I could make writing like my primary role, because computers are very, very curt and nasty. But if you don't format things exactly the way they want, they will simply dig in their heels and not do your bidding. Whereas the English language is very, very flexible and very, very fluid. They almost never do a syntax check, or at least if you confuse your editor enough, he'll just say, whatever, we'll publish it.
Am I still off? Oh, there I am. Okay. We're working on the mics back here. So where did you go to college? I didn't know you were studying computer science.
Rensselaer Polytechnic up in upstate New York.
Yeah, great school.
for computer scientists.
Yeah, actually, it was more for engineering than for science, but that was kind of cool for me because it was kind of like going to a very small school where you could really twist doorknobs and get access to pretty much anything you wanted in the computer science program.
Yeah.
I mean, I still remember the first time I saw a Mac 2, it was like 1 in the morning. I was simply walking through campus, seeing what doors were open, and I see this lab of graduate students who are working on like graphics algorithms and this buffet table that simply had naked boards on it that I was told was a Mac 2 prototype that had been lent to them by Apple because they were trying to figure out how to make a driver work or something. I don't know if that was the culture at other colleges, but it was that I think they learned the most at college when, again, 1 or 2 in the morning, I'm walking along, seeing what doors are open, walking in and just being the biggest dumb guy ever and saying, "Hello, I'm not here to challenge any of your knowledge or your budget. I'm just here so you can pat yourself on the back that you know so much more than a stupid freshman."
Got anything you want soldered? RPI, a great school, and so you were in college doing that, and then driving to Boston for the BCS meetings.
No, I had to take a year or so off.
Oh, okay.
And by the time I took a year or so off, it was like, okay, I'm making enough money.
I did the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Real life impinged.
It was a double thing because I was actually paying. I was actually paying as I go. I had a lot of scholarships, so a lot of help there. And unfortunately or unfortunately, my tuition bill was low enough that if I worked really, really hard over the summer, I could actually pay for most of it and take out a very low student loan. And there was a point which, A, I was having a problem with physics. It was the only class that I was just not getting it, or I was more interested in learning Unix than in learning physics. So a combination of that and, okay, I got to take a year off to make some more money back so I can, you know, afford to go back to school. And again, that sort of interrupted things.
So do you have a novel in the desk drawer?
Yeah, I have a couple.
Really?
It's funny. Maybe it's because of the way that the generation I grew up in, where I'm not used to, if I were born like 20 years later, I might be thinking, if I was born during the era of blogs or grew up in the era of blogs and Twitter, I might grow up thinking, well, I don't care if this is not very good. I'm just going to put it out there and let people take a look at it. I've written a couple that were like, the first one was just stream of consciousness, only worse. So, But it got me into the habit of, okay, here's what it's like to type,
right, you
know, 60, 70, 80,000 words and say, hey, I'm done.
Right.
But I read it like 3 months later and I realized that, okay, this was a learning exercise. Then a couple years later, I finished, like five years ago, a second one that was like, okay, I can see where I was going with that. That's still very good. I think that rather than fix this, I'm going to hold on to that one too and apply what I learned to something else. And so now I'm actually working on 2 pieces of long fiction kind of concurrently that I think are going to be the first things that I actually try to publish.
I didn't know this about you. That's cool.
It's fun when you don't have any expectation that you're going to actually show this to anybody if you're just writing fun.
So that's because you love it.
Yeah, and I feel like I've seen novels that have been written by people who are not noted for being novelists. And I promise you, I'm not thinking of anyone specifically right now, but where it's like he's a very, very famous artist and he got a contract to write a novel. And you can see that, oh, this is very much a first novel.
Yeah.
And maybe he should have waited until he had something good to show. So this is the thing I'm working on right now. I feel like it's original. I feel like it's interesting. More than anything else, I'm having fun writing it. And so that's why that's going to be the first thing that I might put out there.
Is it a genre fiction? Is it a sci-fi or?
No, I guarantee you, you'll be very, very surprised when you see the.
It's a sex novel.
I said surprise. No, it's interesting.
Fifty Shades of Andy.
And if your heart can take it after the first 3, you win a free bowl of soup. Yeah, it's kind of a weird thing. I think it's weird in that it's so plain in what the concept is, because I mean that was the problem with the second novel was I really was trying to be I'm going to try to blow people's minds and have the most out there concept, and I could see that but you didn't story that's great, that's like in anything you do that's creative, I think there's the, it's like Olympic skating where there's the compulsory part of the mm-hmm. judging and then there's the freestyle part of the competition. Mm-hmm. And the freestyle, I was getting maybe 8s or 9s out of 10 on the freestyle portion. But in terms of beginning, middle, end, limited cast of characters, and each character has something to do, and you know what each of these characters want, and you're actively interested in the story, that's the point which I was trying to do the triple lutz and landing on my butt and skidding into the into the boards.
But at least you leapt.
At least I leapt. It's, you know, that's why you really shouldn't worry about how good a piece is. It's really cool just to get to the end of a story and know that you did it. And also, all writing is rewriting, especially with noveling. So, you know.
Well, and I think people would assume, oh, Andy Iannacco, he's going to write sci-fi. So I like now the other thing I would think, and you could tell me if I'm off base or you don't want to talk about it, but you're very funny, and I would think that anything you would write would have a good measure of humor in it.
Yeah, it's there's certainly a lot of that too. I try to take the example though of. You know, of Monty Python, of P.G. Woodhouse, where you really have to have you can. It's fun to have a lot of glitter and a lot of jokes in there, but jokes that don't have that sort of structure of a story behind it. You still have to have a character that you're interested in what they want. You're interested in what they're willing to do in order to get there. And you're sort of invested in what they want to do when they get there. I mean, people sometimes ask me my favorite. They know I'm a big fan of Douglas Adams, and you know, actually, it's kind of odd, but I do think that the Dirk Gently novels are more satisfying than the Hitchhiker's Guide books because the Hitchhiker's Guide books, they're funny, they're consistently exciting, but at the end, I don't know who any of these characters are. Whereas Dirk Gently is someone you really want to know what they're up to next, what he's up to next.
Right, right. And boy, I tell you, with somebody like Douglas Adams out there, who used to be out there, he's no longer out there, but it's a little intimidating. You don't really want to write another Douglas Adams novel. That's been done very well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but it's great when you see examples like that. It's great when you see how difficult Douglas Adams was in finishing the books that he was supposed to be doing.
True.
And P.G. Woodhouse is absolutely the king. He lived to be 97 and he wrote a little bit over 100 novels in his lifetime. And there's a wonderful book that's out of print called Performing Flea. That's all about correspondence between him and this child friend of his from his school days, who also became a novelist. And it's just nothing but him and his friend talking about structure and talking about how difficult it is to write novels and talking about cricket matches at the old school and that sort of stuff. But when you see that, here's how much P.G. Woodhouse's novels, they just seem so effortless. But then you get to see, here's how hard he worked to make sure that every scene in that book was sharp and to make sure that every character was there for a reason. And he realized that, great, it wasn't just a genius who had just vomited this brilliance onto onion skin. He just worked and worked and worked until this thing that was not to his satisfaction was actually to his satisfaction.
Would you like pursuing a career as a novelist if all goes well?
Oh, yeah.
You like writing?
I just enjoy writing. I would be very, very pleased if I finished this novel, I thought it was good and I put it out there and it got an audience. If it sold 1,000 copies, just to establish that, okay, it wasn't just people who follow my Twitter stream who are, again, referring back to these people where Dale Earnhardt Jr. wrote a novel, that would sell. It wouldn't be a very good novel, but hey, it's Dale. I wonder what Dale Earnhardt Jr. would be a novel from him would be like. That would be good. If it actually turned into a career, that would be even better because, again, that pays money, and I do like money. I have a use for money.
It's funny because I get the impression, boy, Andy is so poor. He's always talking about how hard it is and, you know, the ink-stained wretch, the life of the freelance journalist, and yet we send you checks that you never cash.
I do. Well, see, again, I think it's just based on that same, like, one-ahead envelope opening thing where it's like as a freelancer, it's good to know that I still have like a month or two worth of pay
some
that
of the
I have
drawer.
Not. That's no. It's not that I don't. You know, I don't. You know, set fire. It's not like I'm over here saying that. It's not like I'm over here saying that. You know what? I'm only doing it because I love the artwork. I don't want to taint this experience by actually depositing a check.
I keep waiting for you to do that, but no.
No. But yeah, it's just there's given that it's been a number of years since I've had like one of those jobs where all you have to do is show up on time and not smoke in the building and you will eventually get a check. It's like, I like knowing that, you know, whatever the status of my savings, no matter what the status of my checking account, there is another check that's on the refrigerator waiting to be deposited.
I do admire you, though, because the life of a freelancer can be nerve-wracking and difficult. I mean, you're on your own.
Yeah, it's funny, though. I mean, you get used to the temperature of whatever water, like, you spend any time in. I get terrified by the my friends and family members who they have this one job. And if anything were to happen to one that one job,
too, isn't
they
it?
Have no they have no income no whatsoever.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, I like the fact that I have several employers. I love the fact that if I get sick and tired of this one job I'm doing, right. That's great. I can put that aside for a day and do this other job.
Right.
And that if a lot of people would have to go out of business simultaneously for me to have one of those, oh dear, I wonder if UPS is hiring moments.
I still, to this day, if I go buy a McDonald's, I worked, my first job as a teenager was at McDonald's. If I go to buy a McDonald's with a help wanted sign, I make a mental note of it. I still do that. It's just a habit. Oh, that's good. They're hiring. I'll keep that in mind in case this whole twit thing doesn't work out.
You have that on your CV.
I know how to flip a burger. So one thing that we, you know, you're unusual in your field, in that most of us who are in the tech field, some more than others, are like, we kind of live in public. I think of Scoble and Jeff Jarvis and me. You know everything about us. And we know so little about you, Andy. Is that intentional or are you just self-deprecating? What's the deal?
Honestly, I think it's a little of both. I mean, it's realistic in that nobody should really care. No one should really care about most of my life. It's not interesting. It's not relevant to their interests. When I write about something that's related to my private life, like what I did, like over the weekend or experience that I went through, I really don't want to do that unless it's a way that it's written with a certain perspective. And I think the reader will figure out something about life in general or about that experience in general. I often see blogs written by other people that they really just want us to know how they felt every moment of every day. and if that works for them and if their audience likes that, that's fine too. I'm not begrudging them. But I'm like, oh dear, you got to give people an opportunity to miss you a little bit. And a lot of it is just a reasonable desire for privacy. I think that once you start putting your entire life out there, it's almost like a way that you're trying to monetize every aspect of your life and every aspect of your personality. And I think that kind of leads to it'll catch up to you at some point, and you'll kind of wonder if you gave that stuff away cheaply. I'm not judging anybody else, but there are some things that I find very, very odd. Like when I'm reading a Twitter stream and I'm seeing a conversation that really should be private.
Yeah.
And it's not even just like, hey, you know, it looks like I'm over that flu because I just came out of the bathroom and here's, oh, no, don't tell me about that. I don't care. but it's also about, you know, your a sister is talking to a brother and they're talking about their plans for the weekend.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, you realize that. I mean, I know that you only have about like 800 to 1,000 followers, but now all of them know about your plans for the weekend. And do you realize that? And is that really what you wanted to happen? And I feel a little creepy for, you know, seeing that.
You're not the narcissist that most of us are.
I'm a narcissist in private. It's like I'm alone in my house, and I'm the most important person in that house, and that pleases me greatly. But when I step out of that house, I try to realize that not everybody is going to be fascinated by your story about how you found the ultimate tangerine at the market yesterday.
I love that. I think that should be the title of your memoir.
The ultimate tangerine.
No, the narcissist in private.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. So I won't ask you about your love life. I know that your mom, she recently passed away a couple of years ago, right?
About 5 years ago.
Yeah. And I remember that you took care of her. You moved to be near her and all of that. That's about all I know about you.
Yeah. See, and even that was, it was,
Private. I know. I shouldn't have said a word.
No. Oh, I'm sorry. No. Because I was certainly mentioning it on Twitter. I was certainly.
It was a big part of your life at the time.
Yeah.
I'm
well,
sure.
also yeah. because you know when I was living with my mom and taking care of her, of course, like those two hours when I was doing Mac Break, you know, mom was in the next room, and sometimes I have to get up, and so it's kind of hard to explain. Here's why, you know, suddenly I'm in this other place. But again, I hope I don't miss the mark. It's just that as I say. There's a degree to which I don't want people to think that I think that my life is quite that important. And when I did talk about that sort of stuff on the air, I realized that there are a lot of people who are in that sort of position, and they don't know what to do. They don't know if they're going to get through it. And sometimes if you deliver that sort of example, not saying, hi, I'm an authority on this, but simply saying, here is what my experience was. You're probably going to find some familiarity. And I did when I delivered my mom's eulogy, I did post that to my blog because I just wanted the world to know what an awesome mom my mom was. And it was her request that I deliver her eulogy as stuff that I put in the blog. And I felt as though it would please her to have that on my blog in addition to sharing it with the 100 or so people who are in the church.
Yeah. Hard thing to do to read your mom's eulogy.
Yeah, I mean it is harsh. The lesson from there that I hope that I get opportunity to share with other people is that you are gonna as you watch your parents get older, you're gonna start to wonder what's gonna happen when they need someone to take care of them. Are you gonna be able to step up? Are you gonna be able to do what needs to be done? And the fact of the matter is that if you have that kind of relationship with your parents, and I'm not be presumptuous for me to suggest that everybody has that kind of relationship with their parents, when the time comes, you just start focusing on, nope, this person needs me, and here's what I'm able to do in order to help. And so you just get through it day by day and know that it's a great opportunity to have a chance to repay some of the love that this person gave you during your childhood when you were in need of assistance day to day.
That's what family means. Do you have sisters, brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have a bunch of siblings that live mostly in New England.
Oh, so they're around?
Yeah, we were very, very fortunate in that we were able to sort of divvy up a lot of these responsibilities into really fiefdoms, so to speak.
Good. And that helps. Yeah.
Yeah, and given that you know I don't have kids and I have a job where I can try, you know, I was going to take a financial hit for that amount of time, but I could still do some of my work, even though I was, you know, a wall away from my mom. I was certainly the best candidate to do that sort of stuff.
Nephews and nieces?
Many and brilliant.
Oh, see, you never talk about them. I bet you, you're a perfect uncle.
This is actually an interesting topic of conversation because part of that is that, I don't feel as though I have a right to. Right. I have a right to take a picture of my breakfast and post it on Twitter. As much as it annoys people, sometimes the breakfast is just so beautiful you just want to share it with people.
Your diner pictures are this make me very hungry. I just want to say
that's what they're intended. It's anything I can do to support the independent dining industry and convince people to look for something an independently owned diner instead of going to Denny's.
Yay!
I feel as though that was very valuable posting. But I'm within my rights, I think, to share that part of my life with the public. When I choose to proud as heck of my niece's play. I loved being there. I was, of course, the embarrassing uncle with the pan with a long lens who's taking click, 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 click. I was suspiciously silent when anybody else was on the stage, but who cares? But I feel like, you know, that's my sister's moment. That's my niece's moment. And I'm thrilled to give them the pictures that I took. And if they want to post them, that's fine too. If they want to talk about it, that's fine too. But I feel like it's the safety you have to play is that, is this person going to be bothered by that? And just the fact that you make sure that they have that level of control, I think, is the most important thing.
This is one of the things I really enjoy about you, Andy, and really respect about you. No matter what we talk about, you often seem to have thought more deeply about it than I have, and always have something that's a little bit beyond just the surface, the obvious to say about it. It's why you're so great on Mac Break Weekly. Is kind of this depth of your thought.
I think, well, I think part of it is because I don't want
to. Because you're alone a lot and you spend a lot of time thinking about
it. You know, I will absolutely admit to that. My best thinking time comes when I'm an hour away from someplace. I just have an hour to drive. And sometimes I will have like little arguments inside the car, not with an invisible friend or Wilson volleyball in the other seat. But it's like that's a time to really think about I'm going to make a statement and then I'm going to try to challenge that statement. I'm going to defend my original statement and then say, well, OK, maybe you have a point about this part that you put onto it. And part of it is just I don't want to be an idiot.
Right.
Most
of us don't mind being idiots.
Well, most of us don't have to fill like 8 hours worth of air.
That's
every
true.
Day.
I have an excuse.
It's like when I do a TV. I've never been more impressed. I never really started being so impressed with the talent that you see like on the weekend on the morning newscast or whatever than when you are on that set and you know that this is something that you prepared, a segment that I prepared maybe 3 or 4 days for. This is someone that this person had maybe 4 minutes this morning to look over a briefing paper and they got it.
Yeah,
and they can be alert and ask the right questions and make sure they don't look foolish. If there were a book of simple, dumb advice that people should take or that I wish I'd given myself earlier in life, it's that it's okay to take 3 seconds and think before you say something. It's okay to dump something through a preprocessor for a little sweetening before you put it into the vocal output buffer.
Right. Do you talk to yourself?
Who else will? Who else is going to stand up with an ego as big as mine?
And on the other hand, you say,
no.
Mr. Inotko. No, I think of the long-form pieces that you write for the Chicago Sun-Times, the three-parter you just wrote about why you switched phones. It's always much more thoughtful than the stuff that you normally see online, which is generally, you know, cranking it out every day, and it's not, you know, it's not really thoughtful. You take the time to kind of think about it and say, well, this is why I did this. This is why I think this is important. I think that's great. It's unique. Another thing that's unusual about you, unwilling to share your personal details, and you think about things. You don't belong on the internet at all, Andy.
Well, the internet seems to agree with you there.
You're a great photographer. I have to say, I love your. Is that a hobby for you? Is that something you take seriously?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if I'm any really very good or not, but it's such a fun thing to be at an event and to be trying to find that one right picture. I was at the PAX East, you know, the gaming convention here in Boston, and man, it's one of the great things about these compact system cameras is that I can now have like the camera and 3 lenses and everything without looking like I'm a field reporter in Hanoi in 1971. But yeah, I was excited because I've got the long zoom because I'm at Bill Amend's Q&A panel. I want to get a good portrait of Bill Amend, even though I'm seated what 13 rows back and there's not much light here and there are people in costume. And I want to I love taking pictures of people in costume because that's almost you're 70% of the way towards an awesome picture because this person just looks awesome. But it's also the challenge of I probably have 5 seconds, maybe 10, to make all the decisions I need to make in order to take two and probably exactly 2 snaps. So that if I want to say, I want you to stand like sort of 3/4 to me, I want you to turn your face towards that wall, but turn your eyes towards me. And if you could sort of like poof your hood out a little bit as though you're sort of peeking out, that'd be great too. And you get home and you're like, oh, that's about 70% of a good picture. And then you spend more time in Photoshop and screwing around with things. I just love that aspect of it. I very much love the fact that thanks to digital, I can take 100 photos and wind up with 3 that are actually good enough to keep, let alone put on Flickr. But at the end of the game, when you came away from an event with 2 pictures that you think are really, really very, very pretty and interesting enough to share, that's a really great point of pride.
Here's one from PAX.
Yeah, that's a case in point because there were a lot of problems with that shot. It's odd that I'm going to a gaming convention because I don't really play those sort of games that take days and days and days to play. And while I was mousing around with this, I realized that, well, this is my version of video gaming. because I opened an aperture, made a few tweaks, and put it on Flickr. Meanwhile, the window is still open. I look at it, say, "Oh, I should really get rid of that. There's an aluminum bar like behind them. I should like Photoshop that out." I'm thinking, "Ooh, there's sort of a color cast over here. I should probably remove that color cast." It's not as though I'm spending 9 hours on this picture, but it's just that, you know, I finished writing something. I'm taking about a 45-minute break. Instead of like picking up an Xbox controller, I'm like clicking into Photoshop and thinking, I really think if I put a little bit extra green, I know it's a little artificial, but if I put a little extra green in his eye, that would actually look a little bit better. And then 20 minutes later, I've uploaded the 13th revision of this thing to Flickr, and I'm back on to the next thing I'm supposed to be doing. But it's like, okay, that's a fun little game to play.
Andy's Flickr site is Andy I. His Flickr handle is Andy I. By the way, I love this one of the keyboards going down the long
view. I like that too. But see, we get back into privacy because sometimes I worry that because I promise you there was nothing particular about that girl that was in the mid ground that made me take that picture. I was looking for that shot of a line going all the way into infinity of hands on keyboards. If it were a guy, if it were anybody else, and if he or she happened to be turned with their face so that you could actually see part of their face, it would have been the same picture. But there's a part of me that thinks, okay, is she going to be pleased or upset that a picture of her wound up on the internet, more so that this creepy guy took a picture that included her without her knowledge? And it's such a complicated issue because there are times when I have had to talk to somebody that I've just taken a picture of and said, "Are you serious? Are you really complaining?" I was at the Boston Comic Con last year. I remember this so clearly. And so I'm trying to make sure that I get enough pictures that I can tell the whole story. And part of it is, here's the line of people that were waiting at 9 a.m. to get in for this show that started at 10. And so it was just like people like lined up on a sidewalk and just basically, here's a widescreen view of, you know, 500 people in line. And then so I took the snapshot, and as I'm entering, because I've got a press pass, first of the headline saying, "Excuse me, I didn't give you permission to take my picture." Mm-hmm. I don't want a picture of anybody that does not want their picture taken. So I said, "Oh, okay, I'll delete it." Said, "Well, you can delete it, but you already took the picture." At which point I sort of had to like say, "Sir, you're on a sidewalk as part of 500 people. I wasn't taking your picture. If you thought that you had an expectation of privacy sitting on a sidewalk at a huge public event, I don't know what to tell you, sir." That said, when I used that picture, put it on Flickr, of course I cropped him out because, again, I don't want someone in that picture who did not want the shot in there. But it's something that I find fascinating, that there are people who go way beyond that. That if you are in anywhere in public, they will cite you the chapter and verse of law that says, "Sure, you're on a public sidewalk. You have no reasonable expectation of privacy, and so I'm entitled to take this picture as long as I don't use it for commercial use." And I'm like, dude, you basically put your camera 2 feet away from this guy's face without asking and took his picture because you thought that he had an interesting face. You know, do you think that maybe he would have been upset at that? Maybe you could have asked first. No, I got the legal right. I don't care that you would have the legal right. It's not a nice thing to do.
You're such a nice guy. I mean, I think the people who do street photography, one of the things that they get over is caring about whether they're annoying people.
Yeah.
And you're just a nice guy.
I don't know.
I still get great pictures. I love this cat. Did the cat give you permission?
The cat's a cat. He's not aware of anything that any humans do. We are just simply like nitrogen atoms in the air.
We're servants. We're their servants. And of course, you're Holsteins, which have made them all over the world.
Yes.
Yeah. The other thing I know about Andy Nocco, loves comic books. Is that a childhood obsession or is something you came to later?
Late-ish. Maybe when I was 12 or 13, maybe. There was sort of an arc to that where I was really into comics until I was in my mid-20s. And then there started that sort of slow fade. It was kind of weird that I had to sort of dissect my own hobby in a certain way, where week after week after week I would be coming back from the comic book shop with like, you know, a dozen comics or so, realize that, oh man, I didn't like that. Then read the next one, oh man, I really didn't like that. So then another one, say, oh man, I've read that story a million times before, didn't do anything interesting, it was disappointing, it was poorly drawn. But when you've bought comics every Wednesday since you were 12 or 13, or for the past, you know, 10 or 15 years, you forget that not buying comics is actually an option. and so I'm serious. It became like a slow transition from I'm going to start to not buy comics that annoy me, which also frees me from the obligation of telling people how much a certain comic I didn't enjoy annoyed me. The big breakthrough was when, you know what? I've had this comic for 3 months. I've read it a few times. Now I'm going to throw it away or give it away. I'm not going to save it.
Wow.
Ooh, exactly. It's like I don't save. You I didn't rebel. Save old copies of People magazine. Why was I saving old comics that are, you know, it wasn't like here. This one is personally signed by Jesus Christ himself and group edited by two apostles. So it's going to be worth money someday. It's like, no, you're just putting them in boxes and never opening that box ever again. Perhaps you could do something better with that space and with your time.
I'm going to get back to comics in a second, but I just came across a photo that you obviously re-uploaded to your photo stream of the 8-foot bride of Harvard Square, who we now know was Amanda Palmer. Mm-hmm. And do you know Amanda? I think you do.
No.
This
was a photo I took in 1999. I blogged about it at the time and, to my surprise, got an email because saying that, wow, I'm not really a fan of living statues, but she really turned it into a performance and something interesting. And about a month and a half later, I got an email from her saying, "Hi, I'm that 8-foot bride. Thank you so much for saying those nice things about me." And that was really the only time we've ever been in contact.
She used this image in her TED Talk. You know, you get photo credit in the TED Talk.
Yeah, it was credited me very nicely twice. Once the name was misspelled at the end credits, but that's okay. But that wasn't. She approached me about using this photo. Through Neil Gaiman's blog, she's looking for photos of, if you have photos of her in performance at any event, she's using that as part of her talk. Right. And I thought, hey, I've got a picture of this person in 1999. There are probably not many photos of her from 1999. I bet this would be handy to her. I sent her assistant or the email address that was provided. Here is the link to the Flickr page, which was fun because through the assistant, I learned that, no, she does want to use that. Do you have like a better, higher resolution version of it? And this was like a 2-megapixel camera. And that was back when all editing was destructive editing and you didn't really care about preserving the entire film roll. And so when I had some time a few days later, it was fun to go through, dig out all of my archive hard drives.
Wow.
And going through iPhoto libraries. And man, was I pleased when I found the original from the camera. And then the second step from that was that, so now I have the original, what the camera spit out, and it looks horrible. And the version that I had posted to Flickr was heavily edited, as good as you can get with iPhoto, like 1.1 or whatever. But now I have Aperture, which has so many more controls to it. And I can also throw into Photoshop. And man, was I surprised and pleased with the amount of detail that was in that picture that was absolutely buried and unrecoverable by the photo tools of 1999, 2000. Because it's actually quite a credible photo. There's a lot of work going into that one.
Yeah.
That's why I entitled that one when I posted it to Flickr, reposted it, that this is the remastered edition.
Right. And I don't know. For some reason, you seem like you could have been a Dresden Dolls fan, but maybe not.
Actually, yeah, there was.
Seems like your kind of music. I don't know why.
I did. There was a. We all have our like favorite music playlists. There's a one song of theirs called "Good Day" that I absolutely love. I had a really nice moment. I think it was like 2 years ago, maybe, where I'm working on email, and this song comes up on repeat play. And this was before Amanda Palmer really came back as a solo act, or at least I wasn't really aware of it. And I said, gee, I wonder what happened to the Dresden Dolls. Then, of course, you get distracted with Google searches for 20 minutes. Now Amanda Palmer's doing it. Okay, now here's a piece about Amanda Palmer. That's interesting. Like, oh, she was an 8-foot bride in Harvard Square. Like, huh.
Wait a minute.
You know, I have a picture of an 8-foot. Oh, my God.
How many 8-foot brides could there be?
have I unknowingly been a fan of this person that I took a photo of in 1999?
Her
music?
I love it.
So, like, sometimes this internet thing, it will creep you out a little bit.
Beatmaster in our chat room asks me to ask you about the big edit, your philosophy to get rid of things.
Oh, yeah, it's something that I have to do. I believe that about once a year, you have to really get all your stuff together and throw out any really put your hands on everything you own and try to decide whether or not you want to keep it or not. And if I turn the camera around and you saw the rest of this room.
Oh, go ahead. Let's see it. Come on. Come on.
Not happening. I don't do a really big one every year, but every few years it really becomes I'm going to go through every closet. I'm going to go through my storage unit. I'm going to go through every room in the house. And just I refer to my storage unit as it's sort of like the classic version of the Mac trash can, where I can if I put something in the storage unit, I'm throwing it away, but I can still open it up and take it back again. And it's always amazing when you go back and you dig to the very, very back of it and you realize here is a book that was the most important thing in the world to you in 2002 when you put it in a box and put it in here. And now you just couldn't care less what happens to this thing. And so sometimes it takes a while for the perfume of covetousness on a certain object to sort of like clear itself from the room, so you can actually get rid of stuff. But yeah, I mean, I am a clutter guy. Unfortunately, I'm not. I'm so grateful to all these hoarders shows that are on cable, because I watch this episode and like the episode ends, I turn the TV off and I say to myself, self. You have a problem with clutter. Fortunately, you have never wanted to save plastic bags just because to have plastic bags. You have never you've never shouted at somebody that no, I know that plate is covered with cat poop, but I can clean the poop off. You know, those people have an organic problem. You simply have an organizational problem that you can. I think today, because the recycling day, the recycling depot is open. Perhaps tomorrow, perhaps tonight, you should find another couple of trash bags worth of stuff that you can feel as though you can get rid of. And it's like, oh, your heart goes out to people who really do have that sort of organic disorder where, you know, I've got, you know, what do I have here? Just on the floor, here's a micro USB hub that maybe I've got a bunch of these. And like, this does not free up many oxygen molecules in my office if I were to throw it away. But, you know, I would not have much of a problem in getting rid of this. I don't have an emotional attachment to it. But it's like, there are people who are like, no, I know I don't have the power supply to that. And it uses a style of USB connector that I can't find the cable for, but maybe someday I'll find that cable. And you're so grateful that whatever problems you have in life, you don't have problems that require medical attention and medication. Because that's very sad.
Indeed. So tell us something we don't know about you. You don't have to be too revealing, but just – in fact, there's probably a lot of things you could tell us we don't know about you.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of something that would be even remotely interesting.
That's good. Everything we don't know about Andy is boring anyway, so don't ask. Don't worry about it.
Oh, geez. Maybe that I lettered in swimming in high school.
There you go. Wouldn't have thought that. Be honest with you.
I do have my Letterman jacket up there. I disappointed the heck out of the coach when I said that, no, I was not coming back for a second year. I promise you, I swam like long, the long swims. And because it was not a thing that the team was competitive with in any way. So it was okay for me to lose it by 3 minutes to everybody else in the pool. the good news was that by the end of the season, I had gone from finishing about a minute behind everybody else to finishing a consistent 10 seconds or 15 seconds behind everybody else. That was fine. But it was also significant because, man, 2 weeks in, I just hated that so much. And because it was so boring. It's just nothing but every day after school, you're just doing laps and laps and laps and laps. And it's like, oh, I have so much things I would much rather be doing this, you know, this semester than doing this. But I did decide that, okay, I feel as though I did join the swim team. I can't quit. I have to see this through to the end of the season. And so I saw it through the end of the season, then told myself, you don't have to do this again. You can go back to typing after school, which is something that is just as calisthenic you're more successful at.
You have such a strong moral foundation. Are you a deeply religious person?
I wouldn't say so. I identify as agnostic. I believe that the questions of religion are more interesting than the answers are going to be. I went through a thing a few years ago where I tried to, after identifying as agnostic for so long, ask myself, well, are you really an atheist, but you don't have the courage to go out and say, you know, you were raised with a certain religion and you're turning back on this and saying that, yes, I'm an atheist? Or by the same coin, are you scared because you work in such a technical sort of field and so many of your friends are scientists and so many people are skeptics? Are you afraid to say, no, I do believe in God? And I went through a lovely period where I was just sort of trying to get as much information as I could and talk to as getting as many opinions as I could. And I really came back to the fact that no answer that I saw, including the answer there is no God, was as interesting or as nourishing to me as the question of what do you believe and why do you believe that? Mm-hmm. And as opposed to in parts of being a moral human being, it's just easier than being amoral or immoral. I try to make sure that I'm an okay guy to hang out with. I try to make sure that, you know, if you hang out with me, you may like it, you may not like it, but at least you didn't think that I was being an insensitive jerk.
Yeah.
But the problem is the problem with insensitivity is that by its nature,
you don't know.
You just said something stupid and insensitive.
That's my excuse anyway.
Yeah. It is interesting, isn't it? Because there's so many of these simple things that you need to pick up as you go through life. One of them that I've been reminding myself of, like, you know, as I stop being a young man and start being a not an old man, but at least a not young man anymore, was realizing that, you know, I know that when someone says something to you, you had an idea for a joke or something sarcastic. You do have the option of not making that sarcastic comment. There was it came up, as a matter of fact, a week or two ago, where someone was at the table said that, hey, their kid's going into journalism. And of course, the joke is that, oh, well, I hope you also take up rock music so you'll have something reliable and profitable to fall back on. But, you know, it then stopped myself before I said it and said, you know, that's good. That's great, because this is a great time. You can go on Tumblr and become a journalist, and all you have to do is write well and be good at what you do, and you'll find an audience for that stuff. I really hope that things work out great for you. And it's like, okay, that was a more thoughtful thing to say. I'm glad I wasn't a jackass during that.
You're good, because I go for the joke every single time, yeah, I deeply regret it almost every single time.
I know, it's right there.
It's right there.
There's a big red button. And you just slap that and boom.
All right, I'll give you a tidbit nobody knows about Andy Inako. He invented the Macquarium. Is that true?
I don't think I invented it. I certainly didn't, because I think the first Macworld Expo I went to in 1985.
You saw one.
I saw it's you have a Mac Classic Mac. It looks a little bit like a boxy aquarium. People will naturally try to do it. As a matter of fact, I think that there's after I started writing about this sort of stuff, someone sent me a tech note that was I don't know if it made it outside of Apple, but someone inside Apple had figured out a way to do it. But it was such a complicated sort of glass structure you had to build in order to fit inside this that I wasn't really tempted to try it. So I was doing the Q&A column for a Mac user, and this is when the Mac Plus was the Mac Plus, the Mac SE were like the current Macs, and someone asked, well, how can I make my Mac 512K useful? And of course, Mr. Creativity, Mr. Clever Pants, Mr. Sarcastic said, well, you can turn it into an aquarium. That would make it useful. And then I went on and actually answered the guy's question. But that led to like all kinds of people writing and say, well, how do you turn a Mac into an aquarium? And so it was fun because I spent like a month and a half trying to figure out how best to do this. Not only how to make it work, but also how to reduce it to a simple set of plans that anybody could follow, as opposed to this other set of plans that I'd encountered later on, which is just all these weird angles and you need to be a really good glass cutter. But nope, just go take this sheet of paper to any place that cuts window glass, have them give you these sheets of glass, put it up with silicone, make this wooden platform, boom, it works. So if I have a version of the resume that I'm not sure that I can really back up, a line on that resume is that I published one of the first ebooks, because there was no such thing as a World Wide Web. There was 92, maybe 93. And Mac user was not going to be able to like publish this like 6,000 word book with illustrations inside the magazine. So I just said, look, I'm posting this into the forum on CompuServe. It's a Word file with pictures inside it. Download if you want to hear all the plans. And I also put in the front of it, you know, here's the, I'm giving this away for free, but it's not public domain. Make sure if you put it wherever you want, just keep my authorship there. And if you don't build these and sell them for profit, because, you know, figure that out on your own. And just if you want to thank me in any way, donate blood to the Red Cross, and we'll consider that even. So it's very, very pleasant. As a matter of fact, in one of the storage lockers, I do have still about a dozen, like maybe even a dozen and a half old Macs. Because there was
you
a
do.
Time when,
I was wondering.
Yeah, because there was a time when people would like ask me to like donate one for like a raffle or something.
Right. Make one.
Or I would give one away as a gift, or I would give away the one that I had in my office and I had to make another one. And back when Massachusetts started charging money to dispose of computers, I found that the price of the MIT flea market on an old Mac used to went from like $50 to $10 to $5 to, I have a pile of these here in the booth. Just take as many as you want, because I don't want to have to pay to have these disposed.
I take you back to 1993. Dr. Mac, Bob Levitis, and a very young
It teaches you how Andy to take an obsolete Inocco. Macintosh and turn it into an aquarium. You got to see this. So, Andy, tell us a little bit about...
Boy, the quality's terrible on this.
...what drove you to create the Macquarium.
Well, it all started out in a quest for me to decrease my word count by making a joke about upgrading a 512K Macintosh.
No mutton chops.
That being the only really
useful
thing
you
can do to
it.
The
fedora.
Of course,
God, I still
a
miss
torrent
that shirt.
Of mail followed saying, well, how actually do you do it? Which led to an 8-month odyssey of trial, error, and successes and failures. Well, we don't want to upset certain senses.
You had a little more of a Boston accent failure. Back then, Andrew.
But, you know, the ones that are in there right now, thankfully,
are
benefiting
from the failures.
Before
I spent more time overseas.
That is on YouTube if you want to see more of it, as is, I see, Bob Llewellyn's interview with you on his carpool show.
Yep.
What? One last question. Coolest thing you ever found at the MIT flea market?
That would be a. That would actually be a either an original Altair 8080,
ooh,
or the door from an Apollo trainer. And the door was not for sale. It was this guy had actually managed to acquire from a defunct museum, like a training version of the or a test bed version of an Apollo crew capsule, and he was trying to. Of course, it had been sort of gutted out, and he was trying to like find people who had parts so we could restore it to like its original, I don't know, flyable condition. And it's just like, oh, it's a. Can I pretend to be an Astrodome gym level staring out through that window? Can you take my picture staring out through that window, sir? All I have is $130, but I can go to the ATM and get more.
That's the best reason to live in Boston, the MIT flea market, and Andy Inocco. Andy, great to talk to you. Thank you for joining us today on Triangulation.
Always cool to chat with you, Lou.
Yeah, always fun. Nice to spend some time just talking. Just talking.
Yes.
And is that Indiana Jones behind you there? We always have to ask. Andy always has amazing backdrops.
That is a Jim Steranko concept art painting of Indiana Jones that they Spielberg and Lucas actually commissioned him to come up with. So here's the basic story. Could you paint some scenes of – because he was famous for those kind of like action pulp scenes. And it's actually said that the actual costume design of Indiana Jones came from this one of these Steranko paintings. Wow. They didn't know it was going to be a fedora and a bag and a leather jacket, but it's like, okay, that works. We'll use that. Thank you.
What is the story? I said one last question, but one more. What is the story of the fedora? Because I didn't realize you wore one as long as 20 years ago.
Longer than that. I mean, I don't want that to ever become an affectation because there's nothing more pathetic than, you know, when you see somebody who, like, what's sadder than Hulk Hogan that still has to wear the sweatband and,
right,
like, the ripped muscle T-shirt, as opposed to, well, you're in your, what, is he in his 60s now? It's okay if you wear a polo shirt now. You know, it's okay. But, yeah, I mean, I'm very, very grateful to one of my oldest friends has a picture of me, like, at 17 or 18 with a hat, much like my regular fedora. I wear it because I enjoy it. I wear it in public. I will take it off when it's socially inappropriate to be wearing a hat. And there are days when I don't actually wear it. So it's not something that I have to wear all the time.
It's a great hat and a great choice.
It is a great one. I usually have a box of like four or five of them so that if they ever stop making it, I have at least a 2-year lead time to find another hat that I like.
Oh, so this is a specific brand of fedora?
I found it's just that you find one that you like,
mm-hmm,
and It's inexpensive. It's easily orderable over the internet. So why would I go hunting for a million kinds of that, of different kinds of that? It's like I will simply buy a box of three or four of them. And it's kind of like when Charles Schulz, the cartoonist, one of my favorite stories about him is that there was a type of steel crow quill that he really liked to draw with. He thought was the perfect crow quill. When he found out that the company was going to stop making them, he simply called them and say, "How many do you have in your warehouse?" And he said, "Great, I will take them all." And so he used to like every time he'd get a new editor or something or anything at the syndicate, he would like, and they came to visit him, he'd say, "Yeah, well, I'm glad you came to see me. I mean, I kind of decided that I'm probably going to stop doing the strip as soon as I run out of my favorite crow quill pen." And they're like, "Oh my God, so Sparky's going to be 4 months, a year." That he'd laugh and show him the storage closet with tens of thousands of boxes of nibs. When you find something you like and you have the ability to not have to make that decision again, why make that decision?
Why exactly? Buy more. Thank you so much, Andy. Great to talk to you. We'll see you Tuesday on Mac Break Weekly. When is 5x5's Nocco's Almanac on?
Usually we record every Thursday. Sometimes schedule interferes, but usually posts on Fridays.
Good.
But
5x5.tv, you can catch that as well. That's where Andy talks about all his enthusiasms, the TV shows and movies and comic books.
So that's where you find the person who's not kind and not gentle. And, not. And another thing, hey, if Marvel keeps crapping on the Fantastic Four the way they keep doing it, I don't even know what I'm going to do, okay?
Evil Andy. Thank you, Andy. Take care. We do Triangulation every Wednesday, roughly 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time on twit.tv. Jude, join us live. I like the chat room to help me out with questions. But if you can't, we have on-demand versions of all 96 shows now, audio and video, available at twit.tv/TRI. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Did I say the time wrong? 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern?
It's 3 p.m.
Well, it's whenever we started.
It's 3:30 p.m.
You know when. Tune in.
Just keep the window open. It doesn't cost you anything, for God's sake.
Just leave the window open. There are plenty of bits. We'll make more. Thank you, Andy.
Excellent.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.